outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gym.
You know what I find amazing about God?
Okay.
He can live in here. We talk about presence. He's our habitation. And he can also walk in the room.
Okay, explain more. Unpack that a little bit more for me. I think I know what you're talking about, but explain that to me.
I was sitting here the other day getting ready to do the prayer thing I do with some folks around the world.
Yeah.
And I wasn't even in a prayer mode. I was just kind of arranging things to get ready.
Okay.
And presence came down my hallway.
Ah.
I could feel him coming.
Yeah.
I'm like, you live in here, so you don't have to come out there. And then my door was open, so no open doors. He didn't open a door, but he just, presence walked in here. I never saw anything with my physical eyes,
okay,
but present. And then the words in my head, don't take lightly the task I've given you.
Mm.
I want you to watch with me.
I want you to watch with me.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Oh, we've been doing that. That's what the prayer thing is. It's about watching the world and trying to see it through the eyes of God and then agreeing with God for how that unfolds.
Yeah.
Whatever he's got on his heart right now. And
yeah,
I have felt like that for quite a while. Like this, it's part of that being inside the space of sorrow with him, of agony with him for the world. Watch with me. I've got a globe over here I often sit with, and I literally watch the world and look at different hot spots in the world and different things my heart's drawn to and prayer. And I do at times, you know, I've been doing this for 5 years, so it's easy to kind of go two ways, get bored with it and feel like, what else can we possibly do? Or institutionalize it and just keep doing it because we've done it. And those are two ditches I try to stay out of, both of those.
Okay.
And that was a real renewal. But the wider thing was, because I felt this happen to me. I've seen this happen other times where I know he lives in here. Like I was in the mountains a number of years ago before some darkness came encroaching in my life. And I woke up one morning in bed and I was early. It was like 6 and it was like, come be with me. And I'm like, I'm already here. You're here. So what do you mean come be with you? And then I saw a specific clearing on the trail where Sarah and I walked behind the cabin we were in. And I thought, okay, there. Despite all my theological conviction that God lives here, I can lay in my bed and talk to him perfectly well. And he with me. I got up, got dressed, went outside down that corner of the trail, walked around the corner, and presence.
Hmm.
Presence, just knowing. Like that story I tell when I was a 9 or 10 year old kid and asked God to reveal himself to me and presence came into the vineyard. There are moments when I know he is always with me. It doesn't undermine that at all.
Yep.
But there's ways he makes himself known beyond that, that deeply touches me. I find it intriguing.
No, I agree with you. I've had a fair amount of similar experiences where, again, it's, I know that God lives in me. I know that I'm in constant conversation with him, that his presence goes with me, that I am where he is. And there's that internal dialogue, daily dialogue of like, Lord, what's going on? Or what do you see here? Or, you know, all those different types of things. Yep. But there have definitely been some very specific times where God has invited me to do things with him. And when I say yes, the presence that's a part of those experiences is absolutely, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense because it's like, why would it be more concentrated here than other spaces? Like why would this be a thin space, you know, in comparison? And gosh, I mean, it's wild how some of those moments happen. Like so when I was on a retreat down in Key West with some friends, one of the things that came up was they asked, okay, what was a powerful song that God has used in your life? And so people are sharing, like we're listening to the song that the person shares, and then they're kind of telling us the backstory of why that was impactful to them or how God showed up for them in that moment. And the one that came up for me was this song by an older band from the early 2000s. And this song it talks, it's almost like a conversation between the Father and the Son. And it's Jesus talking about with his dad about going down to earth to fight for and to build a bridge to his people. And as the song is going on, the whole heart behind it is, I can't change the incredible love that I have for them. Like, I know that they've messed up. I know they're not perfect, but I am so incredibly in love with them that I have to go. I was listening to this song one morning and I was on the ranch and I was driving the loader. And it was like one moment I'm putting on feed for the cattle. And the next moment that loader cab is so saturated with his presence that I can't drive it anymore. I had to stop it and put the bucket down because I was sobbing so hard because his presence showed up so intensely in that moment and just completely out of the blue. It was so beautiful. And yeah, it's weird. Like, Lord, what is it about? I don't know if it's just like inviting a friend, like, hey, come share something special with me, or this sunset is really important to me, I want you to come and enjoy it with me, or the spot in the meadow that you talked about. I don't know. I have no idea. I don't know how to explain it.
What I love about it is I can't seem to orchestrate it.
No.
There are times I try to find that kind of presence in moments of desperation.
Yeah.
And it just can't manufacture it.
Yeah.
It's Lewis had a dream recently of these doors in a meadow, and he goes up to the door, and if it opens, then it opens and he gets to go through it. If it's not open, there's nothing he can do to make it open.
Mm.
And I love that. It just explains so much in my own journey of when God opens a door, it opens. That doesn't mean there isn't perseverance involved. It doesn't mean you may have to hang in there and see how God pulls off what he pulls off. But to try and pound down a door that he's not opening is probably what Ecclesiastes is about. Futility of futilities. All is futile, says the preacher. As much as you try and kick at a door, God's not in or behind or around or near or given you. It's just frustratingly fruitless. But boy, when there's that sensitivity to where he walks and how he comes, and then the things that go on in your mind when that's happening, and it's breathtaking. I love it.
It is. And yet, like, I think of the moments where, especially when I navigated some of the more charismatic spaces that I was in, how whipped up into a fervor we would get because we're going to storm the gates for the kingdom and we're going to tear down those, you know, we're going to pound down those doors, and how like emotionally intense and exhausting and frustrating those experiences were. And I can't remember one of those moments where this presence that we're talking about was waiting for us as we were doing that. And as we were pressing in prayer and storming the gates of hell, like it wasn't there. I haven't ever experienced it in those moments. And so it's very intriguing how those moments, we really pressed into those, and we're going to keep pressing into those because that's what we need to do, because there's opposition. And yet it's like the moments that God allows me to encounter, invites me into those thin spaces with him, it's totally him led and not manufactured by me at all, and surprising and incredibly beautiful, like effortless. Like, all I have to do is like show up, and then it's like, oh my gosh, like what is happening right now?
Yeah. When I think about the things for me, when we've really pressed in, pushed the doors, arranged this whole thing, trying to make something happen, they can be incredibly exhilarating while you're in the middle of it, but fruitless looking back on it. It's like,
interesting,
whipped up a whole fervor and all that. This other thing is like, when God shows up, when presence shows up, it's beautiful and it's fruitful. And the stuff that comes out of that bears fruit for days and weeks afterwards.
Yeah.
And I think there's something about us just learning to relax in enough humility to let God be God and not try to inject ourselves into the kind of experience we want and we hope for, and the futility of trying to arrange it. When he has enough of those moments for us, if we can recognize when it comes, and then don't just power through what you're doing, stop a moment to take it in and treasure it. Anyway, I've had a couple of those the last few weeks, and it's been incredibly wonderful. I've enjoyed it immensely. And even in some of those times, I try to talk about some of the things I'd like God to give me some input on, like my cancer or Sarah's trauma healing or whatever. And it's like, no, that's not what this is about. I would like it to be about that, but
could we shift that there though? Like, couldn't we go there, please, Lord?
And there's a sense that I've got that. Let's not worry about them, either one of those. Okay. We can do that. Well, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And I want to welcome you to this episode of The God Journey, number 3 in 2026.
Best thing you heard this week.
You know, I don't know where I heard this, how I heard this. It may have even been a dream. I've actually tried to Google this phrase, and I cannot find it anywhere on the internet.
Okay.
So I don't even know how to source it. I don't think it's original to me, but I don't know where else I found it unless I had a dream. But it was this. The enemy's chief strategy is to make dead things look alive.
Ooh. Ooh, I like that. Okay.
Boy, idolatry fits into that most obviously. But how many other things in our do we try to find life in when there's no life in them? Even quote-unquote spiritual things or religious, like we talked about, some of the banging on the doors that aren't open to us yet. I just think now when I think about, oh, his chief strategy is to make dead things look alive. So I spend all my time with dead things thinking they're alive. Mm. Yeah. Boy, that's a gut check right there. It's me. I don't know where I heard it. I wish I could resource it if it wasn't in a dream, but man, it has one of those things that kind of lives on in the days that have followed. I'm just looking, okay, is this a life thing or a dead thing? This might be a dead thing. Only looks alive.
Yeah. I mean, that honestly makes me think about all of the different counterfeits that the enemy puts out there. That's like, okay, this is a, you know, like social media, this is a counterfeit to authentic human connection. So yes, you can kind of feel connected and it kind of mirrors the real thing, but not really. It actually is not at all about what that is. And it just, you know, and so I just think about that, like, gosh, that rings true to me. Like, it has that feeling of this is a dead thing that kind of feels alive, but even then it doesn't necessarily feel totally alive. So no, I love that. Interesting.
I think tradition's kind of like that. Yeah.
Oh, Kevin
Smith, my friend in Australia, said tradition is trying to get God to do something again that he did once.
Yeah.
We kind of fall victim to that a lot.
Yeah.
Because we don't trust that God is endlessly creative. And his mercies are new every morning. And I don't have to hold on to an old pattern hoping to resurrect him yet again in the space where he actually was once. But I don't go to that clearing anymore, or I don't listen for the hallway thing. I treasure the moment, let it go, see what else God has for me.
I think the interesting thing, though, is that a lot of the movements, or whether it be a church gathering or movement or organization or something that somebody institutionalizes, is often it started as something that God's life was in. So it was alive at one point.
It was.
And then all of a sudden we boxed it up in a coffin and shut the lid and it's dead. but we think it's still alive and there's the structure around it, but it's not actually alive anymore.
But we keep coming and hanging out with the coffin, hoping that one day we pretend it's alive. That's the...
Yeah.
I've done that so much in my life, to pretend something's alive when God has already moved on just to other things. So anyway, so what's the best thing you heard this week?
I had an interesting experience. I listen to audiobooks when I'm sleeping because that just helps my mind be able to focus on one thing. And so it slows it down a little bit. And my normal...
You're actually listening when you're sleeping. But if it wakes you up at a good moment, then okay.
Here's the challenge. I have to be very careful to what I listen to, or it will start working itself out in my dreams. So there's part of me that is definitely listening. So I have to be very careful with what I listen to. And so what I've kind of gotten into listening to is the Chronicles of Narnia. I have all the books in one go, and so I can listen to them all continuously. And last night at about 1 o'clock in the morning, 1:30 in the morning, I got woken up by a quote from The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. And this is the quote: "One of the most cowardly things ordinary people do is shut their eyes to the facts." And I had, that one had me like sitting there in bed, wide awake, staring at the ceiling like, oh.
I'm glad we don't live in a time where that happens.
No, that is definitely not a thing of our era, for sure.
close our eyes to the facts. Don't confuse me with facts. I have an agenda here. I want to keep serving, and the facts only confuse me.
Only confuse my objective or my direction that I'm forcing myself to go.
Yeah, that's sad. It's sad that's how often life plays out. And I'd say politically, it's happening pretty much across the board right now on both teams.
Yes.
I'm going to write the blog comment one day, probably a pox on both your houses, because both Republicans and Democrats are in this space of hatred, adversity, and animosity towards each other that's destroying our country.
And not just, I feel like not even just towards each other. I feel like we're moving into an interesting space right now, more on a national stage, that's like, what is happening right now? Like, there are moves being made and actions being taken without congressional approval, without the, I mean, Senate approval. I mean, there are just actions that are being taken that normally there was policies and procedures and checks and balances that were a part of this because of the implications of said actions. And yet now it's just like, well, I'm going to force them to stop me. So I'm going to keep moving until somebody really gets in my face and tells me I can't do that anymore.
And that was bedrock to the founding of this country, the recognition that any human being is corruptible to the larger extent that they hold power, and that their whim is good enough and everybody needs to follow it or be punished. That's just the dictatorial thing. And man, I tell you what, we are approaching that, and both sides would love to have it in their quiver. And they say now, 70% of Americans no longer appreciate either party. I love that. That's the latest poll out. And I'm going, okay, now maybe we have hope. Otherwise, I'm not sure we're going to be here.
Yeah.
That may be God's plan too. It may be time for the animosity we hold to each other to finally win out and see what that does in God's desire to change the world to his way of thinking. Who knows?
Well, and it's interesting, the sad part is, honestly, one of the things that came to my mind when I heard this quote was some of the stuff that recently has hit the news with Philip Yancey. And it's like, okay, how long were people aware, and was the mission and the ministry more important than the facts and the impact that it was having on people? And man.
Or how well it was hidden.
Yeah. Yeah.
I found that little news bit came across my desk right after I'd read this $62 million lawsuit over who owns Anaheim Vineyards property and assets. That's been a big fight going on for a number of time. And finally, the judge threw it out and said the people suing didn't have the standing to sue because they weren't members of the vineyard, because only the members of the Anaheim Vineyard were the board members. And everyone else was associate members. So
associate
members have no standing. And it was, that just, oh gosh, having been through a lawsuit with a brother in Christ, it makes my heart hurt. And then I saw the Philip Yancey thing, and I've been with Philip. I spent a weekend at a retreat with him. Appreciate his skill, appreciate his heart. And then to find out he's been having this 8-year affair in his 55-year-old marriage, it comes to light, and he's got Parkinson's. His wife is the caretaker, going to hang in there with him. And to find out, oh my gosh, how did you come to this point in your life? This would have been 8 years ago. So you're 47 years married.
Yeah.
And why would you throw all that away for whatever temptation was there? And I don't want to be hard on him as a person. I love him. I pray for him. I prayed for him every day since I've heard the news that God would walk him through light and life and give his wife healing. One of the things I read about that, one thing to his credit, he's just said, I'm done writing. I'm done putting my stuff in the world. I need to go live the words I've written, which is a pretty powerful thing to say.
Yeah.
But then I read this. This is from a critique of the whole thing. He said, Yancey has long emphasized grace, often criticized by some as bordering on antinomianism, the idea that God's grace renders moral law secondary. Paul anticipated this abuse. Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? Certainly not. And this quote, any theology that subtly lowers God's moral expectations eventually weakens moral resistance. Doctrine shapes behavior, sometimes slowly, sometimes tragically. And I get the idea that there's no one more theologically practiced than Philip Yancey. So if we're going to double down on, it's the doctrine we need to double down on.
Yeah.
That's what failed us here. And in the spirit of just love and the book I'm working on with Toby, my question is, what is it about our journeys in Jesus that having 50 years plus in the faith doesn't render having an affair on your wife unthinkable? Not you didn't know the rule, you crossed the line, or you did know the rule and you crossed the line. It's not about rules. What is it about your connection to Jesus, if you had one, other than it's the doctrine and it's the religious practice, it's out there rather than in here.
Yeah.
And that's where my heart hurts. That, my goodness, we've got one of our best wordsmiths who's helped people deal with tragedy and where's God in the midst of tragedy and what's so amazing about grace and some of his wonderful things that he's written. Why wasn't the life of God he lived shaping him from the inside? And that's, to me, that gets to the heart of what just love is about. We're so focused on righteousness, meeting a standard that we, and as long as you meet the standard, everything's good. But when you don't, then the next thing is not just he couldn't meet the standard, but then the betrayal, the deceitfulness, all the things that go along with that. In fact, Tullian Chavidian, who also had an affair a number of years ago, he's a Bible teacher, pastor again, but he's back at it these days. He talks about Philip Yancey saying this, his writing gave countless people permission to wrestle honestly with faith, doubt, suffering, and grace. I've long admired him. His book shaped me, and none of this changes any of that. The news is, of course, heartbreaking. News like this always re-breaks my heart and sends shivers down my spine because it pulls me back into the devastation I caused by my own infidelity, the wreckage, the shockwaves, the lives I love of those altered in ways that could never fully return to before. An affair is not an abstract moral failure. It's a long obedience and deception, and it leaves wreckage in its wake. Real people, especially those closest, carry the weight of betrayal, disorientation, grief, and loss of trust that words alone cannot repair. Any talk of grace that does not first make room for devastation is not grace at all. That could have been the best thing I heard this week.
Whew.
That's pretty powerful. Any talk of grace that does not make room for that devastation is not grace at all. It's evasion. For those affected, it's understandable that hearing about grace in any form might feel like an allergen right now, a better reminder that feels premature or even painful. Boy, that's good.
Yeah.
From a guy who's been there.
I was going to say, I think that's what adds the additional power to those words, because they're very strong words to begin with. But to know that those are coming from a voice that has worked through the choice that he made, the impact that it's had on the people that he loved, and wrestled through the own his own challenges and his own heart with Christ. And man, to be able to write that from the perspective of somebody who's been there, lived it, is still recovering from it. Oof.
And that phrase about can never go back to before.
Yeah.
There's before the adultery and there's after the adultery.
Yeah.
And particularly to be able to hold the people you've wounded and not just, well, I made a mistake, God forgives me, let's just go on. To hold the pain of those whom your acts hurt, destroyed, what life it robbed from other people, that's, to me, that's a real expression of repentance and recognition. And that's where healing can come from. But to realize it, before you let that relationship with another person find a place into your heart, it's not just the affair.
Yeah.
It was a long time getting there. It's got to be a lot of denial involved. And, oh, no, we're just good friends, to where you finally cross the line. And then you hide that with everything you've got. And you live in the tension that my life is a fraud. I'm saying one thing. I'm perceived as one thing in the world, particularly if you're a public person like both of these guys were.
Yeah.
And I'm not that anymore, but I'm going to keep pretending I'm that, hoping this never comes out. And then when it does, boy, and he's got Parkinson's. His wife's going to be his caretaker, and she's committed to stay in this and to work through her pain it, and God bless her. God bless her for that. Again, this is somebody I know and love, and I feel it. I feel it. I'm just sorry it gets there. I'm sorry that the transformation of Jesus is not more real in the hearts of his people. But after 50 years of living grace and life and love and whatever, to see it as, which I don't think he did. I think people get caught in these things in low ebbs of their life, and they make all the justifications we do when we do something harmful or hurtful to somebody. And then they end up trapped in a prison they never wanted to be in and never saw themselves coming to.
Yeah. Yep.
One of the definitions of sin I love, sin will take you further than you want to go and cost you more than you ever want to pay. Man, that's just so true.
Yeah, Jess and I were talking about that the other day, actually. There was a couple in our lives that we're connected to that were navigating a situation of infidelity. And she and I were just having an honest conversation about, you know, if that was to happen, or if you were to do that, or, you know, what would happen. And I made the comment that if that was to occur, like, that I would be open to exploring moving. So like, if Jess was to have an affair on me, I would really want to figure out and be able to move forward, because in my mind, if that happened, there was a lot that I was involved in leading up to that was the precursor that laid that foundation, that was very much involved in my wife's heart getting to the space where she needed something along those lines. I don't know. Like, for me, it was like, Lord, what in both of our hearts and in our knowledge of your love was missing, or what did we not understand, or where was I not seeing my wife's heart in an intentional way? I don't know. Those were just some of the questions that we were wrestling with as we were navigating this infidelity situation that had come across our radar. And we were like, man, what? It's not as simple as, oh, you know, I woke up one morning and I was like, I'm going to have a one night stand. Like, no, it does not happen like that. It is not that simple, and it doesn't happen that quick. And there's a lot of foundation groundwork that's laid in that. And I think about, as you're processing this, I think about your question about, Lord, what about your love? Do I not know that if I did, I wouldn't be tempted by this, or this wouldn't be a challenge for me, or I wouldn't be willing to risk the level of destruction in the hearts of the people that I love for this brief encounter or moment of relational self-satisfaction.
Yeah. And a one night stand would be one thing. 8 years would be something else.
Correct.
That's an awful lot of duplicity. Well, I appreciate the generosity. If it happened to you, to be able to say, how did I contribute to this? I think the devastation, I think women often feel like, okay, I'm going to get blamed. What did I not do that let my husband get off with this? And that's what I liked about his words of, as generous as it might be to do that, it would be rude to go to someone else who's in the middle of this and say, okay, what did you do to contribute to your husband or your wife?
Oh my gosh. Absolutely.
Yeah. So destructive.
Well, and incredibly painful. I mean, that would be equivalent to walking up to someone and saying, with depression, and saying, why don't you just feel better? Like, just get over it and move forward. Like, it's fine. Like, you're making the decision to be there. It's like, oh, hold on. It's like, not helpful. Let's not go there.
But boy, that has been said often to people.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. So just brighten up, smile, get on about your day, make happy.
But I think when you're talking about holding the pain for someone, or even thinking about just love, it's like, okay, if you're working out your justice in my life so that I'm able to live that in the world around me, how does that impact, whether it be, you know, this type of response, how does it impact grace? How does justice impact grace? So when we're talking about this, and we're talking about grace that is born out of action and out of a place of the heart, where is God's justice in that conversation or in that play? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think it starts with justice. I think justice is the fruit of love.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. If I really love someone, I can't abuse them. I can't betray them. I can't lie to them. So there's a breakdown in love. It's not, okay, what's justice and how do I adjust to my partner? That's what one person wrote us about the book. Said, you guys start, a pre-reader said, you start with justice, but then you get back to, it's really about love. If you love well, you will not be unjust toward people you love.
Yeah.
The fact is we need more people to love. We tend to aim our love at the five people I can do it for and not arm ourselves with enough love that reaches beyond that, whomever God puts in my life. Mm. And so that's what I think. I think it's always a matter of, it's not, I don't understand justice and I can't do what's just.
Yeah.
It's, I don't have enough love in here to not be able to abuse you. That it would be unthinkable to cheat on you. It would be unthinkable to lie to you. It's not, oh, I'm not going to lie. That's back to law again. I'm not going to do those things.
Yep.
No. Where has love broken down that I can't be in this moment more aware of you and what this will do to you instead of being aware of me and what my need is and how I'm going to get it fulfilled? And because it's just abject selfishness. Everything in the flesh is what Toby says about the narcissism of flesh. That's the conversion. Yeah. Jesus came to convert us from the narcissism of flesh to the glory of love. Mm. And boy, that's practical. That's not just doctrinal stuff to put in your head.
Yeah.
That's an engagement with presence that actually shapes love in my heart. And then when I realize it, that's when I'm not feeling really good about that person or not wanting to be kind or generous to them or whatever, I'm going to come back and say, where's love breaking down here?
Mm.
Why don't I love them, Father, the way you do? Because if I saw them the way you saw them, then I would be generous and I would be kind and I would find my way through to this. So what I hope people get from the justice book isn't, let's learn more justice, doggone it. No, let's find a deeper resonant love that manifests itself in seeing the other as I see myself, my awareness of the other matching the awareness of self.
Mm.
And where that happens, then living out this way is nothing. It's not hard work.
Yeah.
If love is present, it is hard work if love isn't.
So, but I feel like that happens so frequently. I guess I'm thinking about my own life and in regards to the breakdown of love. And it's like, okay, like I see God's love doing incredible, powerful work in my life, but I also see the breakdown in the love still in a lot of ways. And it's like, Father, I don't think there's a whole lot that I can do. I think it's leaning back in and saying, Lord, I need your love. I need your salvation to continue to be worked out in my life and in my heart, because there are spaces in my world still that there is a breakdown in love, that I don't trust it as much as I should, or that I could trust it in a more deep and authentic way, or fear is still allowed to get in here, or my own selfish well-being is still allowed to influence the decisions here, or my trauma is impacting all of this. You know, all those different pieces.
I'm sorry, I can't let you shoot on yourself. That would just be to deny the whole basis of this podcast. Can't shoot on yourself. Don't shoot on your friends.
Well, and that's, I guess.
But that's a great exploration is my point. My point is not, okay, I got to be stronger. And because 50 years of living in the faith and following the rules doesn't guarantee anything.
Correct.
It's, and we can generally be strong as long as my expedience involves my reputation, you know, for a writer and to be known. You think you'd have every reason in the world to stay far away from the one kind of sin that everybody goes nuts about. You can be greedy, you can be deceptive, you can be dishonest, but cross the bounds sexually. And all the people who've stayed inside the lines hate the people who go outside the lines because they've wanted to and they've not. And their reward, hopefully, is that God's going to be, they're going to get brownie points in heaven. And so they really jump on people who violate that one thing, just like that. 2x2 bunch I've been involved with. You know, as long as the problem was just legalism and difficult authority and arrogance and that as soon as it became sexual, now the eyes are open. There's something wrong here. There was something wrong a long time before, but when you grow up in that soup, you don't see it. It's just part of the fabric of what we do. And particularly you're told this is the right way to do it. And man, this is where I hope love, if love really transformed us, if for the last 2000 years, God's people on the earth have focused on being loved and loving, how different that would have changed the world. Then if we focused on, got to get the doctrines right, got to know where the Trinity follows, you got to do this, you got to go to church on Sunday morning, all the rules we put around, instead of, no, love one another as I have loved you, and by that the whole world will know who I am.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And instead, we treated dead things as if they were alive. That's what we did.
Yeah. And the sad part is that at times we point to the law, we point to the Ten Commandments, which I would say is a dead thing, and say, that's what I'm placing my hope in. That's what I'm going to lean hard into. Like I think about that encounter. It always makes me come back to that encounter that I had with the retreat that I did in California with all the teenage guys. And we were talking about masturbation and some things along those lines. And the question wasn't, what is God's love here? Like, what does his love look like in this space when we're figuring out how to manage your sexual drive and your sexuality as a teenage male? Yep. And all of these pastors were waiting for me at the end of this conversation. And they're like, well, your conversation just gave every single one of these teenage boys a right to go and do whatever they want in their bedrooms at the end of this. And I was like, no, I was asking, what does his love say in this? What is his love through this? Not what are the rules and the shame and the dead things that you're trying to use to control this in people's lives. And then the person who hired me walks up and says, so how many of you guys made it through last week being completely free of that in your life? And they all go dead silent. And so it's not working for the people who are imposing the laws on these teenage males, let alone these poor teenage males who are trying to navigate a whole world of hormones. And never once in that conversation did those individuals point back to, what is God's love for us through this? It was, what is the behavior? What is the modifications? What is the justification, the rules that we can use to be able to shore up that they're not going to go there? Versus, what is God's love through this? What is his heart here?
And we always seem to find out later from the legalists is they were breaking the rules while it was going on.
Yes.
While they're telling other people not to break the rules. Or they don't want them to break the rules that they broke as kids. So legalism just does not work in restraining the appetites of the flesh. Colossians 2 says that. It gives the appearance of outward religion, but it doesn't change the heart. Just love is, how does love change our heart? So the fruit of it is justice. Mm. The fruit of it is that I treat people lovingly, fairly, kindly, graciously. And I don't sue my friends, and I don't teach love one day and lie and betray the next. I don't let greed have, because love would untangle all that if we let love in.
Yeah.
And if we don't let love in, then the attempt to battle it through expectation and conformity, it will succeed for a while. Yeah. But when something difficult happens in your life and despair sets in and you feel like God's failed you in some place, then you don't feel like, well, if God's not going to be faithful there, then I don't need to be faithful here. And that's where I find people I've talked to, that's where we break the rules, quote unquote.
Yeah.
In times of despair, if we're up and things are good and I have a vested interest in presenting an image and I can control that image, then it may be worth it for me to do what's righteous.
Yeah. But
boy, those people really hate folks when they fall, because they're either hiding their fall or they wish they could, because it is difficult to restrain human appetites as a matter of will.
Yeah.
Only when love finds its way into our heart and can rewrite the script of our hearts.
Well, and it's interesting because I feel like the oxymoron is that often learning to live loved, learning to live out of your identity as a loved son or daughter of the Most High King, is seen as more dangerous and more threatening than the law. It's like, oh no, we don't really want them to learn how to live loved and live in the identity of Christ and learn how to hear the voice of God. Like, what will they need us for anymore? How will we continue with our multi-million dollar programs? They won't be dependent on us anymore. And they lean back into the law and say, no, this is where we're going to go.
Yeah. And that's been the great struggle with life and love and grace and the new covenant is it's uncontrollable. You've got to meet love, let love win its way into your heart, let love change you from the inside out, and then live out of that in the world. Mm. If it's just fleshly restraint, it will wear out someday. It may last 47 years of faithfulness, but it will wear out someday when you're weak, when the right circumstances present themselves, when you just don't care anymore to try and hold to the standard. And then what I love about, who was this guy? What I love about Tullian Chivilian's response is to look at the devastation that it does to other people. That's what love would do. It wouldn't look at my embarrassment, my shame. I got to protect me. Oh my gosh, what have I done to the people I love? Mm. And then how do I repair it? How do I not just, well, God's forgiven me. You should forgive me too. No.
Yep.
No. Grace allows us to go into the darkness with the people we've hurt and find a way to comfort, to heal, to repair. And that's the challenge. And it's so, we so don't teach that.
Yeah.
Our procedural view, again, calling dead things alive. We're going to say, this has got to work. This is the only thing we've got. So we got to do our best. And I know so many people who feel that way. Instead of, it's a failure of love. And it's a failure in my heart to respond to love. It's not a failure to the rule. It's a failure of my heart to respond to love. Now, how do I respond to love here? Yeah. Best time to plant an oak tree is 25 years ago. Second best time is today if you didn't do it then. And that's where you got to find it. And that's, unfortunately, too many people don't find it in a way that's transformative until it's too late.
Yeah. I think that's when you talk about grace and his love, it genuinely takes that to be able to embrace the pain without letting shame take you out, right? Because then the shame mars your ability to be able to let love do what it's doing. Because true repentance is, okay, I'm holding this, I'm feeling the devastation that my actions caused, but not going into the space where you are completely allowing that to cut out the identity of who you are in Christ. And so walking that line and navigating that, it's not an easy space to be in or to try to untangle.
It's not, because most of our answer is, well, somebody's failed. There's been a moral failure here. Yep. So what we need is accountability.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Which involves the shame and performance. We're right back on the treadmill again. Instead of, if this is a failure of love, how do we find our way into the reality of love that can then bring healing in its time and bring freedom in our hearts and minds so that we can own the devastation we caused? At the same time, we can repair it and let love triumph yet again in even the messes that we've created. And that's, to me, the hope of the gospel.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.